Last week we saw a transition in the life of Israel as a nation. We saw that Israel became a nation with a king instead of the king God that they had from the very beginning. They now had a human king. And that's a transition from what we had before with Israel being led by judges, which we saw in the book of Judges. And we've kind of been seeing a lot of judges over the last few weeks. So with this point of transition, we now are moving out of judges into a kingship. Who was the last judge? Where do we see the last judge? And if you remember back when we looked at the book of Judges, there's a cycle that occurs that people fall away from God. The Israelites would fall away from God, follow other gods, worship the Asherahs and the Baals. And then God would allow raiders to come in and enemies to come in and create problems for the Israelites, who eventually, sometimes after many years, would turn back to God, repent, confess their sin, and ask for God to save them. And so we've seen that over and over again. God would then, in his mercy, do so, would raise up a judge to save the Israelites out of their trouble and rescue them. They would then turn to faithfulness during the time of that judge, and then after that judge, we see the cycle would repeat again. Where is the last judge? Well, the last judge that we see in the book of Judges is Samson, right? Who's the enemy that Samson's dealing with? The Philistines. This is the biggest enemy that the nation of Israel has to deal with at this time. All these other enemies that the Israelites dealt with during the time of the judges were small little local powers, or not necessarily small powers, but nothing like the Philistines. The Philistines had a massive army with massive chariot force, and nothing that the Israelites could physically, as humans, compete against. So after Samson, we see that the Philistines are still there on the scene, and the Philistines are still a problem because we still have apostasy. We still have faithlessness on the part of the Israelites. So we move on. We had the book of Ruth, which is a story that takes place during the time of the judges, probably before this time, time of the Philistines. And then we move into 1 Samuel, and there is where we see our last judge. We see that the Philistines are still a problem, and we see the same cycle that we see in the book of Judges with other judges. If you look back at 1 Samuel chapter 7, and we won't read all this, but you can see they go into battle against the Philistines, and verse 10 of chapter 7, when Samuel was sacrificing the burnt offering, the Philistines drew near to engage Israel in battle. But that day Yahweh thundered with loud thunder against the Philistines and threw them into such a panic that they were routed before the Israelites. The men of Israel rushed out of Mizpah and pursued the Philistines, slaughtering them all the way to the point below Beth Kar. And then verse 13, so the Philistines were subdued and did not invade Israelite territory again. Throughout Samuel's lifetime, the hand of Yahweh was against the Philistines. And then verse 15, this is the confirmation of that. Samuel continued as judge over Israel all the days of his life. So we see that Samuel, not only do we see the judge cycle during Samuel, but we see that Samuel did count as being a judge. And he's the last one that we see that with, that he's the last judge of Israel. And not only did he count because he fits the cycle, but he did the work of a judge. He had a circuit that he went around, and you see that in the next verse, verse 16. From year to year he went on a circuit from Bethel to Gilgal to Mizpah, judging Israel in all those places. And he served as the leader, and Israel recognized him as the leader. So that later when Israel decides, hey, we want to have a king just like everybody else, who do they go to? They go to Samuel. Okay, they don't go to the high priest, they go to Samuel. Samuel was recognized as the judge, as the leader. He was also recognized as a prophet. So that was our last judge. And as we said, why was he the last judge? Chapter 8. When Samuel grew old, he appointed his sons as judges for Israel. So his intent was to continue on the judgeship in the family. Now we see some judges who did that before. Some of the smaller judges we talk about how their sons succeeded them, or their sons served as judges as well. And so Samuel had that intent here, but the problem is, in verse 3, his sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain and accepted bribes and perverted justice. just as the sons of Eli that we see at the very beginning of 1 Samuel when we first started looking at this. The reason that God raised up Samuel, a man after his own heart, is because the high priest who was supposed to be leading the people and supposed to be providing that interface between God and the people was not taking care of matters, and his own sons were very corrupt and wicked. And now we see the same sort of problem with Samuel's sons. So a good prophet, Samuel was a great prophet. We see Eli was faithful, but his sons weren't. So a good prophet, a good father does not make, necessarily. So we see that his sons were wicked. So that, therefore, verse 4, all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah, and they said, "You're old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now, appoint us a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have." And we looked at that last week, and we saw that it wasn't just because Samuel's sons were not reliable and dependable and honest and trustworthy. It was because we got this massive force out here, the Philistines. We've got all these other problems that we keep running into. And, you know, they have a king to lead them. We don't have a king to lead us. Well, we talked about they did. That king was God, but they didn't trust that king. They didn't follow that king. They didn't obey that king. They didn't look to that king to provide the leadership and salvation that they needed from a king, even though whenever they needed it and their backs were up against the wall and they did turn to that king, they did turn to God, that God always took care of them. But they were hard-headed and didn't necessarily learn that. So they asked for a king. So the judgeship then ended, and the leadership of Israel then went to a kingdom. And we had the story we saw of Samuel picking a king for them, someone who looked like a king. Okay? The guy was head and shoulders above everybody else. He looked strong. He looked like someone who would lead you, someone who could lead an army, someone who would... He looked like a king, handsome, etc. So he presented them. They accepted him. And then Saul went back home and went back to farming. Okay? He didn't act like a king until there was this big crisis. Okay? There was a crisis in Israel, in Jabesh-Gilead, where the Ammonites came and attacked Jabesh-Gilead, and then the Spirit came upon Saul, and he started acting like a king. And he recruited people to go into battle. They won this battle. What did, after that happened, what did the Israelites do after Saul had this victory? Chapter 11, verse 15. All the people went to Gilgal and confirmed Saul as king in the presence of Yahweh. There they sacrificed fellowship offerings before the Lord, and Saul and all the Israelites held a great celebration. So what did they do? They said, "You know, Samuel, you're right. He is the right guy. You know, we picked him before, or you picked him before, and you presented him to us, and we said, okay," and there were a few people who didn't agree, but now he's acted like a king. Now we see he's our king. Now we're going to follow him. So not only does Saul now start to lead, but the Israelites now start to follow. Okay? So now Israel has a king, and they see that they have a king. Until this time, they were led by judges, not just the big judges that we see in the book of Judges, but judges against Shophet is the word there, and it means leader or director or judge or hero, or it can be interpreted in a number of ways. But you had a leadership within each tribe. This leadership is the kind of leadership that was set up by Moses back in Exodus 18, and leaders of 50s and hundreds and thousands and etc. You had that within the tribes, but then the tribes kind of did their own thing, and it was a loose confederacy. On occasion, we saw that the tribes would come together. On occasion, we saw that the tribes would fight together or fight against each other. Now, though, they were united. Now, instead of having the judge, and Samuel had brought unity to Israel. All of Israel kind of looked to Samuel as the judge, as the leader of Israel. So Now, though, this is being passed on to a king. And now you have rules of kingship. So far, all of the leaders of the Israelites to date, from the very beginning, from Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, from Moses, to all the judges, to Joshua, how did they get to be the leaders? Every time, it was because they were chosen by God. It wasn't from lineage, okay? It wasn't from inheritance. It wasn't like Samuel setting up his sons to be leaders. Although that was kind of his desire and intent, that's not what happened, okay? It wasn't elections, a democratic kind of thing. It wasn't coups where someone decides, hey, I want to be king, so I'll go kill off everybody. We're going to see some of that stuff later on as we continue on. But so far, all the leadership was leadership that's chosen by God. And in fact, when Israel looks to a king, that's what we also see here. And when we have a kingship that is faithful and righteous and brings Israel into a right relationship with God, it's because that king was chosen by God. And you see here the first king, Saul, is chosen by God. And we'll see as we go on that God continues to choose the key kings. So God has chosen this king. The people have accepted him. Samuel is old. He's been the leader. What happens often when some new leader, other than in a democratic society like America, what happens when you have a leader and then someone else becomes a leader? A lot of times the new leader will wipe out the old leader and all his friends and family and make sure that there's no challenge to the throne. Obviously, maybe Samuel's sons might want to be king. Well, Samuel, by appointing Saul and by making this so public, kind of stem that. But there still could be a potential risk, or people could say, hey, you know, Saul, Samuel abused me here and his family owes me this, that kind of thing. So Samuel recognized all that, and he did something to make to prepare a peaceful transition in leadership. We see that in chapter 12. Samuel said to all of Israel, I've listened to everything that you said to me, and I've set a king over you. Now, you have a king as your leader. As for me, I'm old and gray, and my sons are here with you. I've been your leader from my youth until this day. Here I stand. Testify against me in the presence of Yahweh and his anointed. Whose ox have I taken? Whose donkey have I taken? Whom have I cheated? Whom have I oppressed? From whose hand have I accepted a bribe to make me shut my eyes? If I've done any of these, I'll make it right. You haven't cheated or oppressed us, they replied. You haven't taken anything from anyone's hand. Well, Samuel said to them, then Yahweh is witness against you, and also his anointed is witness this day, that you have not found anything in my hand. He's witness, they said. Okay, so he made sure he had the Israelites agree that he had led honestly, that he hadn't done anything to abuse the power that God had given him, and he acknowledged the passing of the leadership here. Here you've got a king, I'm passing the torch on to him, Saul's going to lead you now, not me. But if I owe anybody anything, let me know now, and I'll make it right. They said, you don't. Okay, so he made sure there was no reason for any kind of overthrow or any kind of punishment or any kind of retribution. He cleaned the slate there. Okay? All right, now, so Saul has been king. He's had a battle here, and the people have accepted him, and God even told Samuel that he should appoint Saul as king. So did Samuel accept that now? Did he feel by this time that adding a king was a good thing? Okay, starting at verse 12, and this is Samuel talking to the Israelites. He says, but when you saw that Nahash, king of the Ammonites, was moving against you, you said to me, no, we want a king to rule over us, even though Yahweh, your God, was your king. Now then, stand still and see this great thing that Yahweh is about to do before your eyes. Is not the wheat harvest now? I will call upon Yahweh to send thunder and rain, and then you'll realize what an evil thing you did in the eyes of Yahweh when you asked for a king. Then Samuel called upon the Lord, and that same day the Lord sent thunder and rain. So all the people stood in awe of the Lord and of Samuel. The people all said to Samuel, Pray to Yahweh your God for your servants so that we will not die. For we've added to all our other sins the evil of asking for a king. So what did Samuel think about by now? He still opposed the idea of adding a king. He still felt it was wrong for them to have done so, that God was their king, that they rejected God in the process of asking for a king, and he wanted to make that point, right? Well, there's really a bigger point that he's trying to make here. And I skipped a couple verses here that we'll go back and look at to kind of see the key point. He did make a point. You know, he says, I'm going to make thunder and lightning, or I'm going to ask God to bring thunder and lightning. And sure enough, it did. You know, they didn't have the weather channel. He couldn't tell beforehand what was going to happen. He didn't know there was a big front coming or whatever. This was something that was there to show the hand of God with Samuel here. So what was the point that he was trying to make? Go back to verse 14. I'll start at 13. Now, here is the king that you've chosen, the one that you asked for. See, Yahweh has set a king over you. Now, if you fear Yahweh and serve him and obey him and do not rebel against his commands, and if both you and the king who reigns over you follow Yahweh your God, good. But if you do not obey Yahweh, and if you rebel against his commands, his hand will be against you, just as it was against your fathers. In verse 24, but be sure to fear Yahweh and serve him faithfully with all your heart. Consider what great things he has done for you. Yet, if you persist in doing evil, both you and your king will be swept away. So what's the key point he's trying to make here? Be faithful. Okay? Be faithful. Now that you've got a king, that king needs to be faithful, and you need to be faithful. And I pray to God that you will always have a faithful king above you. Because a king could easily turn you astray. A king could easily make up his own religion and turn himself into God, such as what we've seen with some of the other nations. Okay? So just make sure that you and your king remain faithful. So the torch is then passed. All right? Well, let's go on. Let's talk about this first king, Saul. Now, remember, when Saul first started acting like a king, that was when the city of Jabesh-Gilead was having trouble with the Ammonites. And so Saul rounded up the Israelites and got a bunch of people to volunteer. How many? How many people responded to Saul's early call to arms to save Jabesh-Gilead? Back in chapter 11, verses 6 to 8. When Saul heard their words, that is, the words about what was happening at Jabesh-Gilead, the Spirit of God came upon him in power, and he burned with anger. He took a pair of oxen, cut them into pieces, and sent the pieces by messengers throughout Israel, proclaiming, "This is what will be done to the oxen of anyone who does not follow Saul and Samuel." Then the terror of Yahweh fell on the people, and they turned out as one man. When Saul mustered them at Bezek, the men of Israel numbered 300,000. And the men of Judah, 30,000. So 330,000 men came and went to fight in this against Jabesh-Gilead. Now, they all volunteered for this service in response to these cut-up oxen being shipped around. Saul, from that, took his own permanent army. Okay, he kept some of them for his permanent army. How many? Chapter 13, verse 2. Saul chose 3,000 men from Israel. 2,000 were with him at Michmash in the hill country of Bethel, and 1,000 were with Jonathan at Gibeah in Benjamin. The rest of the men he sent back to their homes. So out of 330,000, he only kept less than 1% to be part of his army. Obviously, he probably handpicked and got the strongest soldiers and the like. So he had 3,000. 2,000 of them he kept with him at Michmash, and then 1,000 were with Jonathan at Gibeah. Gibeah and Benjamin. What's Gibeah? That's where Saul's from. That's his hometown. Okay. Well, who's Jonathan that it's talking about here? Well, if you go on, chapter 14, verse 49, we see that Saul had three sons, Jonathan, Ishvi, and Malchishua. The name of his older daughter was Merab, and that of his younger was Michal. So he had five kids, three sons, the oldest of which was Jonathan. So Jonathan was the heir apparent. He was the oldest son of the king, so he was the prince who would become king. And so he had one-third of the army, and Saul had two-thirds of the army. So, how did Saul recruit new soldiers during his reign? He started out with his 3,000. How did he recruit new ones? Verse 52 of chapter 14 says, all the days of Saul, there was bitter war with the Philistines. So you see, he needed new soldiers. And whenever Saul saw a mighty or brave man, he took him into his service. Okay? So he drafted into service those that looked like they'd be good warriors and good soldiers. Now, that's what made up Saul's army. How well equipped was his army? Chapter 13, starting at verse 19. Not a blacksmith could be found in the whole land of Israel, because the Philistines had said, otherwise the Hebrews will make swords or spears. So all of Israel went down to the Philistines to have their plowshares, mattocks, axes, and sickles sharpened. So on the day of the battle, verse 22, not a soldier with Saul and Jonathan had a sword or a spear in his hand. Only Saul and his son Jonathan had them. So how well equipped were they? Very poorly. When the Philistines had taken charge of everything, they had made sure that no skills existed in Israel to be able to make weapons of war. That if anyone needed metalwork done for their farming equipment, they could come to Philistia and come to a blacksmith in Philistia and get it taken care of. But they had made sure that there weren't any in all of Israel. So therefore, they really had no weapons against this mighty, powerful army. The Philistines were a very powerful army with chariots like tanks of the day, and very well-equipped soldiers and well-armored, well-weaponed, all of that. Okay? So that's the army that we have. 3,000 who were recruited with very poor weaponry. All right, after that first success against the Ammonites, where does Saul's army turn and place its focus now? Going on, chapter 13, verse 3. Jonathan attacked the Philistine outpost at Geba, and the Philistines heard about it. Okay, so Jonathan and his group of 1,000 attacked an outpost that was there in, not too far from Gibeah, where he was, a town called Geba. And the Philistines heard about it. Then Saul had the trumpet blown throughout the land and said, let the Hebrews hear. So all of Israel heard the news. Saul has attacked the Philistine outpost. So Saul's taking credit for Jonathan, but he's king. He can do that. And now Israel has become a stench to the Philistines. And so the people were summoned to join Saul at Gilgal. Okay, so when Jonathan did that, word got out. How do you think the Philistines might react to that? They wouldn't be real happy. So they would come in force. These Israelites are thinking pretty highly of themselves. We got to stop them before it gets too far out of hand. So you would expect them to come in force. That's what Saul's thinking here. So he sends out a rally cry to recruit more people to help support this army of 3,000, because they're going to need it against this mighty force, the Philistines. So how did the Philistines react? Verse 5, the Philistines assembled to fight Israel with 3,000 chariots, 6,000 charioteers. So here the Israelite army had 3,000 very poorly armed soldiers. Well, they had just 6,000 charioteers. 3,000. They had a chariot to go against one every single man of the Israelite army. And then on top of that, they had soldiers as numerous as sand on the seashore. We see it in verse 5. Okay. And then they went up and camped at Michmash, which is where Saul had had his people, but now he had gathered his people at Gilgal. He was gathering people at Gilgal. So the Philistines went to Michmash, which is where Saul had been with his army before. Okay. So when the Israelite army saw this huge army and powerful, mighty army of the Philistines coming, did that scare them? You would think it would. But they had just seen God work. Okay, they had just seen that God is on their side. They had God on their side. They had just defeated the Ammonites very handedly because of God's intervention. So they should know that. You would expect now, okay, maybe they're a little scared, but hey, we got God on our side, so it's not going to be a problem, right? Well, let's see. Verse 6. When the men of Israel saw that their situation was critical and their army was hard-pressed, They hid in caves and thickets, among the rocks and in pits and cisterns. Some Hebrews even crossed the Jordan, went way across the Jordan, as far as they could go, to the land of Gad and Gilead. Why across the Jordan? Because that's the total opposite direction from where the Philistines are coming from. Okay, so they're getting out of town as hard as they can. So you see the Israelites were scared, and they ran away. And a lot of them hid in caves and thickets. So that pretty well decimated Saul's army, right? Well, how many were left with Saul? Verse 15. Saul counted the men who were with him. They numbered about 600. Okay, 600. He had 330,000. That got pared down to 3,000 when they got done with the Ammonites and people went home. Now it's down to 600. Okay, 2% of less than 1% of what they had when they attacked the Ammonites. Well, the Philistines are a lot stronger than the Ammonites. How on earth can they stand up against the Philistines? Well, what should they do? Okay, he knows the Philistines are going to attack, so he's got to come up with a plan. Before he does anything, what is it that the Israelites were supposed to do before entering any kind of battle? Now, if you look back at 1 Samuel chapter 7, verse 5, this is before an earlier battle against the Philistines. And Samuel said, "Assemble all of Israel at Mizpah, and I will intercede with Yahweh for you." So what were they supposed to do? They're supposed to inquire of God. They're supposed to look to God, call upon God, and seek His will. Is it your will for us to go into battle? Is it your will for us to do this? Okay. So that's what they were to do. Now, before Saul went to Gilgal, Samuel had given him an instruction the last time Samuel and Saul had seen each other. What was that? Chapter 10, verse 8. Samuel says, "Go down ahead of me to Gilgal. I will surely come down to you to sacrifice burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, but you must wait 7 days until I come to you and tell you what you are to do." Okay? So Samuel had given him the instruction, go to Gilgal. Okay, where's Saul? He's at Gilgal. So he's followed that part of the instructions. And Samuel says, "I'm going to come down and I'll sacrifice burnt offerings. I'll inquire of the Lord for you, but you're going to have to wait 7 days." Okay, so it's kind of a little test here, I guess, a week-long test for Saul. So what happens? Does he do that? Back to our story in chapter 13, verse 8. Saul waited 7 days, okay, the time that was set by Samuel. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and Saul's men began to scatter. Okay, so on the seventh day, he's waited 7 days, just like Samuel said. But my army's going away. I'm down to 600 people. The Philistines are getting more recruits. The Philistines are becoming a bigger problem. But that's what Samuel said. Just wait 7 days. So going on. So Saul said, "Bring me the burnt offering and the fellowship offerings." And Saul offered up the burnt offering. Just as he finished making the offering, Samuel arrived. And Saul went out there to greet him. Okay, so Saul couldn't wait. He sees his problems getting worse and worse. It's been 7 days, or it's on the seventh day now. Samuel hadn't shown up. So Saul takes matters in his own hands and does the sacrifice. He turns to God and offers a burnt offering himself. Okay? Sounds like the right thing to do, right? Well, let's go on. Verse 11. "What have you done?" asked Samuel. Saul replied, "When I saw that the men were scattering, and that you didn't come at the set time, and that the Philistines were assembling at Michmash, I thought, now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I have not sought the Lord's favor. So I felt compelled to offer the burnt offering." Okay? I'm just doing what I think needs to happen. We need to seek the Lord before, we need to call upon God before we defend ourselves, before we can fight the Philistines. And they're going to come any time, and I'm losing my army. You weren't here, so I went ahead and did that. What's the big deal? Okay, well, going on. What was wrong with Saul's good intentions, and then what were the consequences of that? Verse 13. "You acted foolishly," Samuel said. "You have not kept the command that Yahweh your God gave you. If you had, He would have established your kingdom over Israel for all time. but now your kingdom will not endure. Yahweh has sought out a man after his own heart and appointed him leader of his people because you have not kept the Lord's command. What was the problem? Sounds like he did the right thing in terms of turning to God and seeking the Lord, right? The problem was that he hadn't obeyed. Samuel gave him a simple command of, go to Gilgal, wait 7 days for me, I'll come, I'll offer up an offering, and we'll go on from there. Simple little test of faith, and Saul fails it miserably. You know, it looks like he's got good intentions. You know, he looks like he's trying to do the right thing. But what did God want? Did he want the sacrifice, or did he want Saul's obedience? And so we had this test, and Saul failed it. Okay, the same sort of thing goes with us today. What does God want from us? Does he want sincerity in our faith, or does he want true faith? Okay, what's more important, what we believe or how strongly we believe it? Well, Paul kind of talked about that back in Romans when he's talking about the Israelites. Romans chapter 10, he says, "Brothers, my heart's desire and my prayer to God for the Israelites is that they may be saved. For I can testify about them that they're zealous for God, but their zeal is not based on knowledge. Since they did not know the righteousness that comes from God and sought to establish their own, they did not submit to God's righteousness. Well, Christ is the end of the law, so that there may be righteousness for everyone who believes." So, regardless of how zealously the Israelites believed during Paul's time, regardless of how sincere the faith of a Mormon is, or a Hindu, or whatever made-up faith that people might have out there, sincerity in faith is not what God wants if it's not right, if it's not faith in Him. Okay, so it is important. Saving faith must be based on trust in God's truth in Jesus Christ, okay, not in what we think is right. Okay, so we had this situation at Gilgal. So after after his encounter with Saul and being told that he hadn't obeyed God's command, and the repercussion of that is that Saul's dynasty would not continue. Big punishment here. Okay, what happens then? Where does Saul take his army after calling on God at Gilgal? Verse 16. Saul and Jonathan and the men that were with them were staying in Gibeah of Benjamin while the Philistines camped at Michmash. So they went from Gilgal then to Gibeah, which is Saul's hometown, where Saul was. Now, it happens to be about 15 miles away from Michmash, where the Philistines are. Okay, so he's not getting too close, but he's pretty close. He's close enough to cross the mountain ridges and the like. But you see, he kind of went home here again. So the Philistines, what are they doing during this time? Are they busy attack? Are they preparing their attack? And as soon as the Israelites get to Gibeah, do the Philistines plan to attack? Going on, verse 17. Raiding parties went out from the Philistine camp in three detachments. One turned toward Ophrah in the vicinity of Shual, another towards Beth Horon, and the third towards the borderland overlooking the valley of Zeboim, facing the desert. So what were they doing? No, they weren't ready to attack. Instead, they were marauding and going out in the countryside, out to the various towns and villages, and attacking the towns and villages, creating havoc, killing people, and demoralizing the people. Hopefully, word of the problems would get back to the soldiers that their family had been killed or that kind of thing. So they were creating other problems elsewhere. While the Israelites were busy trying to figure out how they were going to fight against the this massive army of the Philistines. Okay, so they were creating other problems to plunder and demoralize the people. Right, now Saul's at Gibeah. Who else is there with him? Chapter 14, verses 2 to 3. Saul was staying on the outskirts of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree in Migron. With him were about 600 men. So you got the 600 men there. Among whom was Ahijah, who was wearing an ephod. Now he was a son of Ichabod's brother Ahitub, son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, Yahweh's priest in Shiloh. Okay, no one was aware that Jonathan had left. So with him, he had the 600 men, and he had Ahijah, who was that? It was Eli's great-grandson. Okay, so he was the priest. I guess maybe the high priest at this time. He was descended from the high priest Eli. Now, it also mentioned that Jonathan wasn't there. Where was Jonathan? Let's backtrack to last verse of chapter 13. Now, a detachment of Philistines had gone out to the pass at Michmash. And one day, Jonathan, son of Saul, said to the young man bearing his armor, "Come, let's go over to the Philistine outpost on the other side." But he didn't tell his father. So he went off by himself, actually with his armor bearer, to go check things out over at the Philistine outpost. Why? Was he trying to be a hero and go and try to save Israel all himself? Verse 6. Jonathan said to his young armor bearer, "Come, let's go over to the outpost of those uncircumcised fellows." That's a derogatory term for Jews. "Perhaps Yahweh will act in our behalf. Nothing can hinder the Lord from saving, whether by many or by few. Or do all that you have in mind," as our armor bearer said. "Go ahead, I'm with you, heart and soul." Was he trying to be a hero? No. He was trusting that God would give victory, whether by many or by few. He knew the story of Gideon and how Gideon defeated the Midianites, the massive horde of Midianites with just 300 men. God would take care of it. Okay, it shows his faithfulness. But you know, he hasn't done what we said is so important here. He hasn't turned to God yet, right? He had not inquired of Yahweh. How would he know that God was with him? You know, he could just be doing this on his own, and God's not going to give him victory, right? Verse 8. Jonathan said, "Come then, we'll cross over toward the men and let them see us. Now if they say to us, 'Wait there until we come to you,' we'll stay right where we are and we won't go up to them. But if they say, 'Come up to us,' well, then we'll climb up, because that will be our sign that Yahweh has given them into our hands." Okay? So that's how he's inquiring of God. Is he says, okay, depending on what these guys do, if they tell us to come up, that will be our sign that God has given them into our hands, that God will give us victory. And then we don't need to worry about how many of them there are, because God is on our side. So what did the Philistines think when they saw Jonathan and his armor bearer? Verse 11. So both of them showed themselves to the Philistine outpost. "Look," said the Philistines, "the Hebrews are crawling out of the holes they were hiding in." The men of the outpost shouted to Jonathan and his armor bearer, "Come up to us and we'll teach you a lesson." So Jonathan said to his armor bearer, "Climb up after me. Yahweh has given them into the hand of Israel." So you see that they saw Jonathan, the armor bearer, and they thought, "Oh, the Hebrews are climbing out of their holes. They're not chicken anymore. They're still chickens, but they're trying to get some sunshine or something." But they gave the sign that Jonathan was looking for to see whether or not God was going to be with them. So was Jonathan correct in trusting God for success? Jonathan climbed up using his hands and his feet. So you see, it's a pretty steep climb he's climbing here, with his armor bearer right behind him. The Philistines fell before Jonathan, so Jonathan would fight them, and they'd fall down injured, and then his armor bearer followed and killed behind him. In that first attack, Jonathan and his armor bearer killed some 20 men in an area of about a half an acre. Okay, so you see Jonathan, you see his faithfulness, you see he was a strong man. You would expect that, being the son of big, strong King Saul. Okay, but you see his faithfulness, and that God worked through him and gave him this victory to kill 20 Philistines here. All right, how did God use Jonathan's success to save Israel from this massive army? Okay, God uses that then. Verse 15, then panic struck the whole army, those in the camp and field and those in the outposts and raiding parties. So it wasn't just this group, this little group of 20 here, but panic struck the whole army and the ground shook. It was a panic sent by God. So God sent an earthquake and it caused a panic inside the army, and word had spread about this attack by Jonathan, and the Philistine outpost had been destroyed. Okay. Verse 16, Saul's lookout to Gibeah of Benjamin saw the army melting away in all directions. So Saul didn't know Jonathan was gone. He didn't know what was going on, but he looks out and his outposts are looking out and saying, "What's happened to the Philistine army? They're melting away." His spies brought word back to that. So what does Saul do? And we see that he shows his weak faith here. Verse 17. Saul said to the men who were with him, "Muster the forces and see who's left us." Because somebody's doing something to cause them to melt away like this. When they did it, it was Jonathan and his armor bearer who were not there. Saul said to Ahijah, the priest, "Bring the ark of God." Now, that may also say bring the ephod, okay, which is probably what it's really saying. At that time, it was with the Israelites. While Saul was talking to the priest, the tumult in the Philistine camp increased more and more. So Saul said to the priest, "Withdraw your hand." So what does Saul do here? He goes to inquire of God. He calls the priest to bring the ephod and the Urim and the Tumim, which we'll talk about later. But he goes to inquire of God, but he sees that things are just going haywire in the Philistine camp, and he needs to act now. If he waits any longer, he's going to lose an opportunity to destroy as much of the Philistine army as he can. So while he's waiting on Ahijah to inquire of God, he says, "Look, it's clear to me God wants us to do this. Just, that's enough. Put your hand down. I've got it. Let's go." Okay? So he didn't have the patience. He didn't inquire of God when he thought it would take too long. Okay? So he takes matters in his own hands. Do we sometimes act like we don't have time for God? Something to think about. So he didn't turn to God. Did God then withdraw his support against the Philistines and with the Israelites that he began with Jonathan? Going on, verse 20. Then Saul and all his men assembled and went into battle. They found the Philistines in total confusion, striking each other with their swords. Those Hebrews who had previously been with the Philistines and had gone up with them to their camp went over to the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. When all the Israelites who had hidden in the hill country of Ephraim heard that the Philistines were on the run, they joined the battle in hot pursuit. So Yahweh rescued Israel that day, and the battle moved on beyond Beth-Aven. Now, so see, God still gave him the victory. Why? Because, you know, Saul hadn't inquired of God. Well, Saul's inquiring of God, or lack thereof, is not going to get in the way of God's plan. God's plan here was to provide a victory against the Philistines through the faithful act of Jonathan, and Saul's lack of faith and faithless act was not going to get in the way of that, and so God gave the victory. Okay. Now we also see some other stupidity on Saul's part. Verse 24. Now the men of Israel were in distress that day because Saul had bound the people under an oath, saying, "Cursed be any man who eats food before evening comes, before I have avenged myself on my enemies." So none of the troops tasted food. So here, the troops were out chasing the Philistines, and Saul says, "Nobody can eat anything until we're done, until we've killed them all." Okay, he just makes this rash statement, this rash vow, this rash curse kind of thing. And after a while, these men are so hungry, they're getting weak because they're having trouble keeping up because they need food. And so he kind of creates a problem here. No one can eat anything before evening, he had said. All right. So how did this vow make things difficult on the men? Well, we've already kind of talked, but keep going. 25, the entire army entered the woods, and there was honey on the ground. When they went into the woods, they saw the honey oozing out, yet no one put his hand to his mouth because they feared the oath. So even though God was providing this honey that would give them strength and nourishment and allow them to continue on the chase, the men couldn't do it because of what Saul had said and the oath that Saul had made them say. And these men were tired and hungry and needed it. Did anybody disobey Saul and eat any of the honey? Going on. Verse 27, Jonathan had not heard that his father had bound the people with the oath, because he was at the outpost, right? So he reached out the end of the staff that was in his hand and dipped it into the honeycomb. He raised his hand to his mouth, and his eyes brightened. Then one of the soldiers told him, "Your father bound the army with a strict oath, saying, 'Cursed be any man who eats food today.' That's why the men are faint." Okay, so Jonathan did it. Jonathan ate some of that honey, but he didn't know any better. He didn't know about the vow. Stupid vow anyway. Okay. Well, how did Jonathan respond when he learned what he had done? Jonathan said, "My father has made trouble for the country. See how my eyes brightened when I tasted a little of this honey? How much better it would have been if the men had eaten today some of the plunder they took from their enemies. would not the slaughter of the Philistines have been even greater? Okay, we could have killed even more of them. We could have wiped out even more of them if we'd have had the strength. But people are, they're too weak because of my dad's stupid statement here. Okay? So he disagreed with what his dad had said and made a stupid and costly command. All right? Well, then, bad things turn to worse. How do things get worse when evening falls and the men are finally able to eat? Verse 31. Well, that day, after the Israelites had struck down the Philistines from Michmash to Ajalon, they were exhausted. They pounced on the plunder, and taking sheep, cattle, and calves, they butchered them on the ground and ate them together with the blood. Then someone said to Saul, look, the men are sinning against Yahweh by eating meat that has blood in it. Okay? So the problem here is that they were so hungry, they were so starving after chasing the Philistines and not having anything to eat, that when they finally were able to eat, they did so illegally. Okay, they did so while eating meat without the blood being drained from it first. Why is that a problem? Well, that's a big concept in the Israelites, and that's what sacrifices and offerings are all about. If you go back to Leviticus chapter 17, starting at verse 10, you see God commands any Israelite or any alien living among them who eats any blood, I will set my face against that person who eats blood, and I will cut him off from his people. For the life of a creature is in the blood, and I've given it to you, I've given you that blood, the life of the creature, to make atonement for yourselves on the offering. It's the blood that makes atonement for one's life. Therefore I say to the Israelites, none of you may eat blood, nor may any alien living among you eat blood. Any Israelite or any alien living among you who hunts any animal or bird that may be eaten must drain out the blood and cover that blood with earth, because the life of every creature is in its blood. That's why I've said to the Israelites, you must not eat the blood of any creature, because the life of every creature is in its blood. Anyone who eats it must be cut off. Is God clear enough there? Do not eat meat with the blood in it, because that is what I'm providing to you under the Old Testament covenant laws, ceremonial laws, to provide the sacrifice. Now, can we eat blood today? Well, there's been the great sacrifice of the blood of Jesus Christ that's been poured out for us. And actually, we eat that blood when we share the Living Supper, the Lord's Supper, the Holy Communion. Okay, we partake in his death and resurrection as we do that. So, the men were eating meat with blood because they were famished. So how did Saul solve this problem? Going on. You've broken faith, he said. Roll a large stone over here at once. Then he said, now go out among the men and tell them, each of you bring me your cattle and sheep and slaughter them here and eat them. Do not sin against Yahweh by eating meat with blood still in it. So everyone brought his ox that night and slaughtered it there. So he did recognize, he didn't support what the men were doing, but his rash command had led to it, had caused others to sin. But then he did try to make amends by setting up this stone and giving them the command to come sacrifice properly and not eat the meat with the blood in it. Okay. Going on, did Saul recognize God's hand in the victory and in the victory through the continued pursuit? Verse 35. Then Saul built an altar to Yahweh. It was the first time he had done this. So this is the very first time Saul had ever built an altar. And he builds an altar to God in thanks for this victory. So, yeah, going on. It says, verse 36, Saul said, let's go down after the Philistines by night and plunder them till dawn. Let us not leave any one of them alive. We'll do whatever seems best to you, they replied. But the priest said, let's inquire of God here. So Saul asked God, shall I go down after the Philistines? Will you give them into Israel's hands? But God did not answer him that day. Okay. So you see, out of thanks, he built an altar out of thanks, but he then was going to go pursue the Philistines without inquiring of God until a priest recommended that he should do so. And he goes, oh, yeah, you're right. We need to do that. So let's inquire. So they inquire, and there's no response. Well, if there's no response, then that tells them something, right? So how did Saul use bad judgment in handling God's lack of response? Are you getting a picture of Saul here? Okay. Saul therefore said, "Well, come here, all of you who are leaders in the army, and let's find out what sin has been committed today. As surely as Yahweh who rescues Israel lives, even if it lies with my son Jonathan, he must die." But not one of the men said a word. Saul then said to all the Israelites, "You stand over there. I and Jonathan, my son, will stand over here." "Do what seems best to you," the men replied. Okay. Did he need to say that? Did he need to say that no matter what it is, no matter who did it, even if my son Jonathan did something wrong, he's going to die for he's going to lose his life on account of it? Did he need to do that? No. So you see a poor discernment, a poor leadership, a poor recognition of what he should do as a leader here. So, what happens? How do they find out who was responsible for the problem? Going on, Saul prayed to Yahweh, the God of Israel, "Give me the right answer." And Jonathan and Saul were taken by lot, and the men were cleared. Now, lot is kind of like throwing dice. These lot, the Urim and Tumim were lots that were carried by the priest, and that's what Ahitub would have, or Ahijah would have had, we saw earlier. And so they threw the lots, and the lots fell to Saul and Jonathan, okay, and cleared the men. Saul said, "Cast a lot between me and my son Jonathan." And Jonathan was taken. Okay, so here God pointed out to Saul that the problem was with Jonathan. Okay, so did Saul regret and try to take back his word to protect his son? Going on, Saul said to Jonathan, "Tell me what you've done." Jonathan told him, "I merely tasted a little honey with the end of my staff, and now must I die?" Saul said, "May God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if you do not die, Jonathan." Now, why does he say it that way? Come on, Saul. You know, he's just piling it on here. He says, "May God deal with me ever so severely if I don't follow through and you die because of what you've done." You see his horrible dad here too, not just a horrible leader of people that are supposed to be faithful. How long did Saul wait before he killed Jonathan as he guaranteed and promised that he would? Verse 45. But the men said to Saul, "Should Jonathan die? He who has brought about this great deliverance in Israel? Never! As surely as Yahweh lives, not a hair of his head will fall to the ground. For he did this today with God's help." So the men rescued Jonathan, and he was not put to death. So you see, all this swearing upon himself, "May God deal with me ever so severely, and you're going to die," and all this stuff, he didn't follow through with it. Why not? Because the men convinced him otherwise. Even though he swore, and we've seen that when you swear to God, you've got to follow through with it. And even though he swore to God, the men convinced him otherwise. Okay? He chose pleasing men over pleasing God. He chose following the wills of others over faithfulness to God. Okay? The men didn't want their hero killed, so Saul broke his promise to God. Why was that wrong for Saul not to kill a son? Well, it's never right to kill your son, right? But here, gosh, we've got a precedent back in Judges chapter 11. We've looked at this, starting at verse 30. And this is Jephthah made a vow to Yahweh, "If you give the Ammonites in my hand, whatever comes out of the door of my house to meet me when I return in triumph from the Ammonites will be yours, will be Yahweh's. And I will sacrifice it as a burnt offering." Okay, so whether it's a chicken or a goat, whatever comes out of the door of my house when I get home, if you give me this victory, I'll offer that in a sacrifice. Even it's a little Fido, okay? So what happened there again? Verse 35. Well, verse 34. When Jephthah returned to his home in Mizpah, who should come out to meet him but his daughter, dancing to the sound of tambourine. She was an only child. Except for her, he had neither son nor daughter. When he saw her, he tore his clothes and cried, "Oh, my daughter, you've made me miserable and wretched because I made a vow to God that I cannot break." So Jephthah, although he had poor discernment and made this rash vow that he didn't need to make, he did recognize that breaking that vow, breaking that promise to God would be even worse than having made the vow in the first place. Saul, on the other hand, didn't have any problem with just ignoring the promise that he had made to God, ignoring the vow that he had made to God. Okay? So you're getting a picture of Saul here and his lack of faithfulness and his lack of discernment. Well, going on, how much longer did Saul fight the Philistines? Verse 46. Then Saul stopped pursuing the Philistines, and they withdrew to their own land. Okay, so even though he had this chance to go chase them down, when God did not show his support, Saul at least followed that and did not continue to pursue them. So he stopped now. But going on, verse 52, all the days of Saul, there was bitter war with the Philistines. Okay, so he continued to fight with them over and over and over again. Never were they conquered, and never were they did they have peace against the Philistines during Saul's reign. Did Saul contend with any other enemies, or was it just Philistines? Verse 47. After Saul had assumed rule over Israel, he fought against their enemies on every side: Moab, the Ammonites, Edom, the kings of Zobah, and the Philistines. Wherever he turned, he inflicted punishment on them. He fought valiantly and defeated the Amalekites, okay, delivering Israel from the hands of those who had plundered them. Okay, we'll talk about the Amalekites in a second here. So we see that he contended with other enemies: Moab and Ammon, which were they? They're off to the east. Edom, which is down to the south. The Philistines, which are to the west, and Zobah's to the north. So what's that saying? Enemies on every side. He had enemies. This was a kingship of warfare, okay, not a kingship of peace. And it remained a kingship of warfare because of his lack of faithfulness and discernment in following God and his disobedience to God. Okay? All right, we'll see one more story here today. What was Saul's next command from God? Chapter 15. Samuel said to Saul, I'm the one that Yahweh sent to anoint you king over his people Israel. So listen now to this message from God. Okay, so remember who I am, and I'm bringing you this message from God. And this is what God says. I will punish the Amalekites for what they did to Israel when they waylaid them as they came up from Egypt. Now, go and attack the Amalekites and totally destroy everything that belongs to them. Do not spare them. Put to death men and women, children and infants, cattle and sheep, camels and donkey. Okay, totally devote them to God. Totally destroy them. Just as with Jericho, right? We saw that with Jericho. Now, it says here, I'm going to get revenge here. It says basically, I'm going to punish the Amalekites for what they did to Israel. What was that? Well, if you remember, very early on, right after the Israelites left Egypt, before they got to Mount Sinai, we ran into this story with the Amalekites. You see that back in Exodus chapter 17, verse 8 says, the Amalekites came and attacked the Israelites at Rephidim. So, without being provoked, the Israelites were leaving as a bunch of slaves. They had no warfare training. Of course, the Egyptians were not going to teach them how to fight. And the Amalekites come and attack them. If you remember the rest of that story, this is that one where you see in verse 11, as long as Moses held up his hands, the Israelites were winning. But whenever he lowered his hands, the Amalekites were winning. So whenever Moses' hands grew tired, they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. Aaron and Hur held his hands up, one on one side, one on the other, so that his hands remained steady until sunset. So Joshua overcame the Amalekite army with a sword. So that we had this attack. And so, in verse 14, even at that time, it said, the Lord said to Moses, write this on the scroll as something to be remembered, and make sure that Joshua hears it, because I will completely blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. Okay? I'm going to destroy him. Well, now under Saul, he gives the command to Saul to do that. Wipe him clean. Wipe him out. I don't want any part of him left. Okay? Totally destroy him, just as had happened to Jericho. So, what happens? Does Saul follow God's instructions? Verse 7. Saul attacked the Amalekites all the way to Havilah Ashur to the east of Egypt. He took Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive. But all his people he totally destroyed with the sword. But Saul and the army spared Agag and the best of the sheep and cattle. the fat calves and lambs, everything that was good. These they were unwilling to destroy completely, but everything that was despised and weak, they totally destroyed. So did they do what God had commanded? Well, started out, they attacked the Amalekites and killed all the people and killed all the sheep and cattle and all that, except for the good stuff. And they kept the king too. So no, they did not obey. Saul does not obey this simple command that Samuel gives him. Saul does not obey it. How does God and Samuel feel about Saul's disobedience? Verse 10. Then the word of Yahweh came to Samuel, I am grieved that I have made Saul king, because he has turned away from me and has not carried out my instructions. Well, Samuel was troubled and he cried out to God all that night. Okay, so they were both upset. And God was sorry that he had made Saul king. Samuel mourned. Samuel didn't have a solution, but God did. And we'll see that next week. So how did Saul explain his actions to Samuel? We'll start at verse 12. Early in the morning, Samuel got up and went to meet Saul, but was told, Saul had gone to Carmel. There he set up a monument in his own honor and has gone down to Gilgal. So, okay, instead of building the altar to God as before, now he builds this big altar to himself, this statue, this monument to himself. So is he giving glory to God? No, he's giving glory to himself. So he not only disobeys God's command, but he gives the glory to himself. Going on, verse 13. When Samuel reached him, Saul said, Oh, Yahweh bless you. I have carried out Yahweh's instructions. He tries to get the upper hand here and saying, Oh, I've done it. Just what you told me. And it was a great victory, Samuel. You should have seen what God did for us. Or what I did for God, I guess, is really kind of what he's saying here. But Samuel said, What then is that bleating of sheep in my ears? What is the lowing of cattle that I hear? Well, Saul answered, Well, the soldiers brought them from the Amalekites. They spared the best of the sheep and cattle to sacrifice to Yahweh your God. But we totally destroyed the rest. Okay? So we destroyed it all except for these good things. And then we kept them so we could sacrifice them. Okay? Sacrifice them to God. So you see this excuse, this lame excuse that Saul makes here. Okay? So how did Samuel remind Saul that he had become great from nothing here? Verse 17. Samuel said, Although you were once small in your own eyes, did you not become the head of the tribes of Israel? Yahweh appointed you king over Israel. And he sent you on a mission saying, Go and completely destroy those wicked people, the Amalekites. Make war on them until you've wiped them out. Why didn't you obey Yahweh? Why did you pounce on the plunder and do evil in the eyes of Yahweh? Why did you do this? You were small. You were nothings. And God picked you from nothing. God built you up and turned you into king over all of Israel. He gave you this simple command to go and wipe out the Amalekites, and you refused to obey him there. You disobeyed. Did Saul then confess his mistake, or did he try to pass the blame? Well, what do you think about what you see, you know of Saul so far? Verse 20. But I did obey Yahweh, Saul said. I went on the mission that Yahweh assigned to me. I completely destroyed the Amalekites. And look, I brought back Agag, their king. This shows you that I destroyed them. The soldiers, they're the ones who took the sheep and the cattle from the plunder, the best of what was devoted to God, in order to sacrifice them to Yahweh your God at Gilgal. Okay? So he says, I did it. I did what I was supposed to do. The soldiers, they kept them, but you know, they did it for a good reason. They're going to sacrifice. They're going to sacrifice them to God. What was wrong with the good intentions that Saul said he had here? Verse 22. Samuel replied, Does Yahweh delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as much as in obeying the voice of God? To obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed is better than the fat of rams. For rebellion is like the sin of divination, and arrogance is like the evil of idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of Yahweh, He has rejected you as king. Okay? So, the bottom line is to obey is better than sacrifice. You know, that sounds kind of familiar. Didn't we just have a story just a couple pages ago in our lesson that talked about that? That lesson was given to Saul and he didn't get it. Okay? It's obedience that's important. Okay? Not acting like we're obedient or good intentions. God wants us all. God wants our whole heart and soul. So after this was presented to him, and here he says, just as he said before, the punishment before was God has rejected you, your lineage, and so you're not, your dynasty's not going to continue. Well, now he says God's rejected you as king, not just your descendants. Okay? Does Saul then come clean and confess his guilt? Going on. Saul said to Samuel, I've sinned. I've violated God's command and your instructions. You know, I was afraid of the people, so I gave in to them. Now, I beg you, forgive my sin and come back with me so that I might worship the Lord. So, you see, he said it was wrong. But what's he doing? Is he really confessing? He says, I sinned. I violated the Lord's command. But, you know, the people made me do it. The people told me, and I was afraid of them, so I gave in to them. So it's their fault, really. It's not my fault. You should have heard him, Samuel. Okay. So he's trying to pass the blame on the people here. What was Saul's consequence for rejecting God's instructions here? Going on. Samuel said to him, I will not go back with you. You have rejected the word of Yahweh, and Yahweh has rejected you as king over Israel. As Samuel turned to leave, Saul caught a hold of the hem of his robe and it tore. Samuel said to him, Yahweh has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to one of your neighbors, to one better than you. Now he who is the glory of Israel does not lie or change his mind, for he's not a man that he should change his mind. So what's done is done. What God has decided has been decided. Okay? Was Saul concerned with getting right with God? Going on. Saul replied, I've sinned. But please honor me before the elders of my people and before Israel. Come back with me so that I may worship Yahweh your God. So Samuel went with Saul, and Saul worshiped the Lord. So what was his concern? It wasn't that he had disobeyed God. He wasn't concerned with that. He wasn't even concerned that he was going to lose the kingdom and the kingdom was going to be passed on to someone else. That he didn't respond to that. But what he cares about is saving face in front of all the people. You know, here Samuel is come to see him, and people can tell that Samuel's mad, and they're having this discussion, but he tells them, hey, at least come back with me and let the elders see me with you and see you with me, and so that they can see we're still a team kind of thing. Okay? So he wants to look good to others. That's what he cares about. He doesn't care about pleasing God. All right, what important job did Samuel personally make sure was completed here? Verse 32. Then Samuel said, bring me Agag, the king of the Amalekites. Agag came to him confidently, thinking, ah, surely the bitterness of death has passed. You know, it's been a little while, and this guy's the prophet. But Samuel said, as your sword has made women childless, so will your mother be childless among women. And Samuel put Agag to death before Yahweh at Gilgal. So he killed Agag. He finished off what was supposed to be finished off. Okay? And now, what happens? Go on. Then Samuel left for Ramah, but Saul went up to his home in Gibeah of Saul. Until the day that Samuel died, he did not go to see Saul again. So that's the last time they saw each other. Although Samuel mourned for him. Okay? Here he had picked Saul. He had appointed Saul. He had showed that Saul was chosen by God. But now God has rejected Saul. And so Samuel mourned that God had rejected Saul as king. Okay? And the Lord was grieved that he had made Saul king over Israel. Let's pray. God our Father, we thank you for the lessons that we get out of your word, especially in the examples of other people's lives. We see, gosh, in the story of Saul, we see that he started out well. He started out with great potential and opportunity, but yet he squandered that, and he failed to trust you, and he trusted in himself. He had good intentions. You know, we often have good intentions, but it's not good intentions that save us. It's not good intentions that bring us into a right relationship with you. Rather, it's our faithfulness and our obedience, and that was something that Saul lacked here. And as a result, you rejected him, because he had rejected you, despite what appeared to be good intentions, or despite him trying to put on a face that looked like he was trying to obey you. Forgive us when we do the same as Saul. Forgive us when we approach something with good intentions but without the relationship and the faithfulness and the obedience in what you've commanded of us. Forgive us when we try to make it look like we're faithful when we're just putting on an act. We thank and praise you that you sent your Son, Jesus Christ, to give us that forgiveness that we need, because we do fall short of your standard so often and so heavily. We thank you in his name. Amen.